Flash Radio is a podcast from and about the GA 2007 in Heiligendamm, Germany. We will broadcast a daily half-hour news summary from the 2nd of June through to the 10th. For more information, go to www.flashradio.wordpress.com.
Hello and welcome to Flash Radio, to podcast number 9. The G8 and the Alternative Summit have finished. And for today's podcast, our reporters have got together and formed a panel discussion, evaluating what they thought on the whole protest. We are curious to find out what you listeners think about the subject. And also, we will bring you a selection of interviews to conclude the G8. You will hear a member of the PGA, the People's Global Action Movement, one of our reporters' reflection on the camps and their function of networking. Then we have interviewed an activist on agriculture and the movement surrounding this subject. And Guilleke Tano from the Alternative Summit speaking on Africa and economics. Finally, you will hear a person working for TAC reflecting on the protests and thinking forward on their plans for the next G8 in Japan. So we hope you will enjoy this show.
The Flash Radio team consists of individuals who have come together to report back from the G8 this year at Heiligendamm. After leaving the camp at Redlich, some of the field reporters sat down to discuss their thoughts and feelings on how they thought the movement went this year at Heiligendamm.
We just come back from a very exhausting week, where thousands of activists were involved in lots of different actions, either trying to blockade, either trying to meet a network, either trying to develop alternatives to this version of globalization that we're currently experiencing. So, in terms of priorities, was it worth it? What was your experience as media activists within those actions? What do you think worked the best? What didn't work, and what should we do instead?
I think it has been the most beautiful experience I have with the activist movement, because I have this vision in my mind of of how these people have been planning the strategies surrounding the place where these people were going to meet and where they were not allowed to trespass. And how they spend many hours and many days planning how to get there with the amazing police force authority against us, and 10,000 people managed to get there, and I wasn't giving them a chance. I left Redlich the day before, because I was thinking police is going to come here and block everybody and not let anybody out of here.
You left the day before the blockade started?
Yeah, I left because I was thinking these people are here getting drunk. I don't think that they are really that strategic, and they are just going to be blocked and they won't be able to do anything. And I left because I wanted to be outside and I wanted to report from outside, and I didn't want to be trapped inside, within the police forces. And then I was amazed to see that people, man, actually they got there, that they actually, the strategies that they worked. The police being so impressive, the way how they were showing the forces, they didn't manage to stop the people. I mean, to me, this has been the most amazing, 8 days I have been.
Well, for me, what I thought took away from it really was that people, I mean, okay, the actions, whether they're successful or not, it's the fact that a huge amount of people are willing to defy people, a big body or a government, a group of eight saying you cannot protest here, and they just ignored it. They just went out and went into the fields and tried to do it. And whether they're successful or not, doesn't really matter. It's the fact that a huge amount of people said, I don't care what you think. I don't care what you're telling me. I'm going to try and stop you. And that's probably more important than whether it worked or not. Because when, you know, we're just people and we don't have an army behind us, but it's the sheer amount of people saying, no, I don't care.
I almost feel like this whole thing feels like a global vote against the GA. It feels like it's the only moment, these couple of days, where people can actually say, we really think that you lot, you eight people meeting, are doing the wrong thing. And it's the only moment where they might pay a bit of attention. So that's why we feel like we have to put so much energy into it to show them how much we really hate what they're doing. I mean, that's, you know, like a visual presence of something. It's like the tip of an iceberg that this is happening and we are here, but there's other stuff happening as well, and, you know, there's stuff happening that we don't know about. And it's, I don't know, for me it's a very visual thing, I think, the blockade, the symbolic thing, and we have to not forget that it is a kind of a symbolic thing, but we also have to do the workshops, do the meetings, do the, you know, treat, you know, the way that we work as a system, and we have to stop, you know, we do networking, and it all comes together, I think. It has to work together.
Perhaps people will be experiencing police repression and violence for the first time, I think. Unfortunately, that's kind of, for me, that sounds like a bit of a concept for someone who's been there. And really, it's more that the threat of violence and it becoming violent, as it were, or depends how you look at it, the promise that it'll become violent from the police, stops people coming. And that's the kind of the figure that should be counted as well. For every one of us that went, that we had five friends who didn't go and wouldn't go because, oh no, it'll be too violent, it won't be safe. And the fact that the police spoke to someone today, who of course backed that up, she got attacked by water cannons, and they resisted the water cannons with tear gas and sat on the pavement, on the grass, by the fence, and then got run over by policemen. And that's the kind of thing, that's why people won't go, actually, and that's perhaps more of the sort of mainstream.
So do you mean that our movement is much, much bigger than we think? That people are staying...
It would be, perhaps, I mean.
Or it would be when we manage to stop the repression.
Well, that's repression working, you know. Because the repression, as in sort of like violence, for example, police violence against an activist, is not necessarily about that activist. It's about the repercussions.
Yeah, the fear that they put into people.
And the images.
It's very real. Images.
But I do feel the feeling leading up to it was that it would be worse, and actually people still came and still did the stuff, and it's, you know, bravery of the people, and also the fact that they're more, you know, they're now more determined to say no to these group of eight. It's like, you know, we're more, much more willing, maybe as a mainstream, but more willing to take risks now. It's like, it's showing more and more that people are willing to sort of take on responsibility, I think.
We are less afraid because we know that we can win.
Yeah, less afraid of opposing these big leaders that have kind of put themselves in the place anyways.
I think Teresa's right when she said that, you know, I mean, we're doing this radio show and we have a team, you know, back home in London, and that's all supported. You know, they weren't physically here in Germany, but it you know, they were supporting this, so it's... You know, and there must be thousands of people that are supporting the GA somehow in making it work and making it run.
And the anti-GA.
There are a lot of them supporting it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I for me, we're just like a tip of the iceberg. And but if they realise that it's just a, you know, they're just seeing a fraction of what the reality of what's going on, then I think that could be enough.
That's why they are so afraid of what?
Yeah, they're petrified of us. They really are, I think.
the Alternative Summit could lay things out and provide, because essentially, you know, you've got loads of people together, there's a potential for networking, for, you know, for laying out, you know, sort of for doing plans and achieving the things we talk about ourselves, you know, after the GA, you know. I guess, actually, personally, we were so busy with the podcast, we didn't, well, I wasn't at the camp enough to know the other groups and to, you know, go around just and talk to people, new people. I didn't go to the Alternative Summit at all, which could have been, again, something networky, for workshops. You know, I mean, I'm willing to wait a little bit, you know, just because of this. I know my experience of this GA has been really focused, but yeah, it just, I mean, initially it just feels like there was no sort of foundations laid on for how do people get together afterwards and do stuff, because essentially it's
after
just
what?
After the GA, now it's, you know, now, you know, there didn't seem to be like main email lists going around, or, you know,
there is a mail
list
where I was receiving all the information.
Sure, no, you were there, so tell me. Yeah,
there was this the mailing list that they were using to get people organized. That's a list.
Yeah, I think, but isn't it more of a networking, you know, personal thing? I don't know, because the blockchain groups are just so big, I don't feel like they could organise another follow-up. I mean, it's up to you now, it's up to the individual to go away and do your thing, and that's how things start. It's like a spark. You know, we've met people that hopefully we'll meet again, and then we can start something else. I don't feel like, yeah, well, they should organise something else for us now. It's up to you to organise something for yourself and for your group, and, you know, you go back home and you do your own thing in your own local, you know, sense.
And now it's time for our big post-GA Summit listeners' question. Was it worth it? Is our time well spent organising the stopping of the G8s, WTOs, economic summits, etc.? Or should we spend more time developing a positive framework for a different world? You can post your reflections and observations as comments on our website, www.flashradio.wordpress.com.
Here's some information, thoughts, and an interview with a member from the People's Global Action Movement, the PGA.
The PGA forum in last year in France, and I was really impressed in the way how they were organized. There were about 5 different cities participating, and they call it decentralized, because all the different cities, they have different themes. They were discussing, some were talking about education, alternative education, racism, and all the different subjects that we normally discuss. And then there was a place where everybody would come at the end and meet there and try to make conclusions to take things forward. And
can you just say what PGA is?
PGA is the People's Global Movement, and it's a movement that started in the 80s. I think the first one was in Bolivia. And what's behind the People's Global Movement
People's Global Action.
Sorry, People Global Action. People Global Action. What really like about the PGA is that they saw how there is this spontaneous people's desire to do things and to get together, and they set up as a kind of encouraging this, and they don't want to have any speakers, they don't want to have any leaders, they don't want to have anything that interfere with anything. They are just, they want to be a kind of ground where people meet and talk and discuss and network. And I don't think that the end of the discussion day, and people were really stressed and they didn't feel that they managed to discuss things as they wanted. But I think the nature of this movement is chaos, and that we are doing things, and although we think that we are not,
Tell me your name or your family.
My name is Panayotis. Originally I'm from Greece, but I live now in Berlin in the last 8 months. And I'm involved with the PGA process the last 8 years, 6 years, sorry.
What does PGA stand for?
PGA is a global project inspired by the Zapatista uprising, more or less, and several activists who met before in the several intergalactical conference who Zapatista organized in Chiapas or in Spain, started to discuss about an idea of a global network of solidarity about Zapatistas, and also to start call people and to involve for new projects and networking new projects and create finally a communication tool.
So what are the Zapatistas?
Zapatistas is a movement of indigenous people in Chiapas, and who uprised in 1994 against Plan Pueblo de Panama. Plan Pueblo Panama is a free trade, wants to set up a new free trade agreement and a free trade zone in the area of Mexico. That means a total destruction of the environment of the jungle there. For example, the rainforest, or wants to develop new GMO farms, for example, and of course supported by United States, and they had a big discussion between Mexico. Was a big discussion between Mexico and United States the last years, all of these years.
And so, can you tell me about PGA and how it works?
Interesting question. I mean, okay, PGA. First of all, we must to make clear and clarify that it's not an organization, and also it's not something like a political party or international that, for example, Trotskyists have an international and try to make a hierarchical structure, a central structure or something like this. PGA is more an idea of exchange and coordinate stuff, and no one, for example, can represent PGA, or no one can say I'm a member of PGA or something like that. And it's only some people, some activists or some collectives, grassroots movements in Europe. I'm talking especially about Europe now, and we can talk later about the other continents. Try to develop stuff and make some struggles more visible. And in the other continents, on the other hand, is more anti-capitalistic movements and some grassroots movements from India, for example, or some peace organizations, or some Ukrainian, for example, eco people in Eastern Europe, or people from indigenous autonomous spaces in Argentina, for example, or in...
Well, it's interesting to know who the groups are, because if it doesn't have a central structure, then it's interesting to know what are those...
The idea of PGA is to decentralize the structure, and maybe it's the most powerful point of PGA is not an organization at all. I have no organization structure. It's more like a global infrastructure. And of course it's not clear who is participating, who is not. And we don't care, I think. The most of the people don't care about this. The most of the people, they care about PGA to exist and give space or help all of these global projects to exist and to develop new struggles and help finally the global resistance all around.
So how do the different groups communicate, and what do they give to each other?
Yeah, this is another interesting discussion, because, for example, I mean, in Europe, I think the mailing list is one of the tools who people use to communicate, or the Wikipedia and other internet tools. Of course, we have physical spaces, and we call these spaces info points, who people can meet there and exchange ideas for new projects or actions. Or, of course, we have an infrastructure of the info points. The info points communicate each other, and we have an internal communication. But in the other continents, it's not so easy, because we are talking about millions of people. I mean, it's something really huge. For example, in India, in the trade unions or other stuff, I mean, you can use the same structure like Europe. And this is one big discussion, interesting to know, about horizontalism. Several activists and several people have a discussion years and years about horizontalism and how can create a horizontal way of decision making, for example, or discussion in the network.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that if vertical systems have built up because people, well, for different reasons, but are those horizontal structures difficult, and how are the problems overcome if they are, to talk at once with so many people? And
maybe if I understood well your question, because my English is not so good anyway. I think PGA have conference, I mean some big conference every 2 years. And the first one is a global conference where people from different continents meet and discuss about the difference between the continents or the mentalities or about the different projects and all the stuff and how can the people coordinate this stuff. And the European conference, who is a smaller conference and have different issues and different topics. For example, one of the most popular topics in who people discuss in the last PGA conference was the autonomous spaces. Or in the global conference, another good topic was intercontinental caravan, who started in 1999, and people from India traveled together with European people, European activists to Mexico, or sorry, first to Argentina, Brazil, and after to Mexico, and after from Mexico, they went to Canada and passed the borders to United States and went to Seattle from there. It was a really huge project. And it was, I think, the most successful project who PGA initiated before. But I think all of this structure organized by meetings, physical meetings. We are called these meetings conference. And PGA in Europe, sorry, it's already did four conferences. In France, Belgrade, Milano, Geneva, who Geneva officially started in 1998.
And can you tell me about where we are right now? And what PGA are doing here this week?
First, I told you that PGA have no membership, and all of us, we involved with different projects. Mm-hmm. For example, me, I'm involved with the project of autonomous spaces and biotechnology, the environmental topic. Some other people, for example, are involved with the media center or take interviews from people like you or do other stuff. But we decide through mailing list to set an info point, an info space about PGA, because we believe that PGA is not visible anymore. Try to make PGA more visible, and that's why we have this info space with the newsletter. The newsletter we decided in the last meeting, the physical meeting, we tried to inform people about PGA and make them to use it. But the most of us, I mean, to be clear, involved with here with several projects, I mean, several.
And because it's for the radio, can you just describe where we're sitting?
Yes, we are sitting now in the info space of PGA, and you can find a lot of leaflets about the history of this project, or about the future of this project, or also for different topics. Mm-hmm. And also in the other tables there are some other leaflets from other organizations or from projects and initiatives.
Thank you. And I understand in an hour there's going to be a meeting about the future of the PGA. Can you tell me what will be on the table?
Okay, the future of PGA is really a difficult discussion for us, because the most of the people had the impression before, and I have the same impression, I think, that networking is not useless, is not no way out. And now we have a discussion to networking real struggles and real topics for sure. And we try to make a big international meeting now, and from people who involve different projects, and start contacts and communicate and coordinate stuff again. This is we want to focus in this topic. Also, we want to focus in the next PGA conference. At the moment, we have two ideas exist. The first idea is to have two regional conferences in the same year, one in Germany in next spring, and one other in next autumn in Greece, in October. Next October in Greece. And also to separate the different topics, and maybe to discuss different topics in both of the meetings. And the other idea is to have a central conference, but in the same time to have a decentralized part in different countries and people to discuss different topics, and after to come in Greece and discuss about the future of PGA and all of this interesting discussion about anti-globalization movement, for example, and beyond anti-globalization movement. And also, sorry, I speak too much.
No, not at all.
Some of us, I mean, and I am one of them, we believe that anti-globalization movement is not visible anymore as well. and a lot of activists, several activists with really good ideas, focus in a really bad idea to organize a campaign 5 days, 2 years now. They have no ideas about the future, about new ways of activism.
What are you referring to when you say they organize a campaign for 5 days?
What? Sorry, again?
What are you referring to when you say that they organize a campaign for 5 days?
Mm-hmm.
What are you referring to? The G8, the alternative summit? Or?
Yes, but for me, we have to move beyond all of this mobilization. Of course, it's really important to meet each other, and now we know each other because we meet here. We met here, but it's really interesting to discuss about the future, about the strategies, the tactics, and the strategies we must follow to develop the anti-globalization movement and make the resistance as effective as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand you're frustrated because mm-hmm. people come from a long way. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put a lot of effort into organizing a huge mm-hmm. thing for 5 days, and then they meet again in a year, yeah.
Or they don't meet again. This yeah. is a problem. Because, I mean, okay, I involve and participate in several anti-globalization protests, and it's always the same. It's like a circle. Mm-hmm. The people meet, they have really good ideas, they have really positive energy to make stuff, and they really, I mean, encourage themselves to make stuff after, but never happened, and we have to discuss why. More or less happened, but not really effective and successfully. Not really successful.
Concretely? How can you see that? Working differently. What
I propose, for example. My proposal is to start again from the first step and to start a big conference after this mobilization and talk what is wrong and what is not wrong, and also to propose new ideas from actions and from activism. This is one of the points. The second point is to create a new infrastructure, and maybe it's interesting as well, all of these people to sit down and talk about a new infrastructure. And
but how would that infrastructure, what would it look like?
Of course, anti-hierarchical decentralized, and all of these things who I described before. Uh-huh. For me, PGA is a tool to help in this yeah. in this process. Uh-huh. And yeah, that's why I continue to believe in this process and work for this process. I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Many people came to the anti-G8 not only to blockade roads, but to create an infrastructure and meet with others on issues that spill over borders and nations, like the global problem of housing. In this interview, we talked to one of the many organisers who plans for the future on the very important issue of housing.
We are in Camp Rederik, on one of the hill of the G8 area. And from here, actually, we have kind of very close to the blockade of the G8, and we've been helping make this summit less successful. What we are here for is for basically connecting different movement of housing and city. We met with different groups coming from different parts of the world. Among them, Novox Network, that has been very active in France, dealing with the right to housing, where they've been occupying a building in the center of Paris and turned it into a minister of housing crisis in January 2007. The building is still active and it's been in process of being developed as a way of kind of social center to become an active place where people can meet and discuss housing issues. And from the occupation of a building in January in Paris, three different buildings were occupied all over Europe, one in Barcelona, one in Italy, and one in Brussels, created other different minister of housing crisis and relating this issue internationally and European level. And that was the main reason why we are here, to network all this group together with the group of Habitat International Coalition that called this meeting, together with the organization of MNML that is coming from Brazil and was one of the organizations that set up the urban landless of Brazil, together with the homeless people organization of Osaka that were here represented, and together with the Neura Network, the International Network of Urban Research and Action, and various different other organizations, from Tenants Association in a local area of Germany in Wuppertal, Tenants Association in Berlin, with many, many other. The goal here is to keep on networking, to keep on networking together on the rights, to strengthen the movement of the housing, of housing movement all around Europe, and to call for action in October, in the first week of October, on a global action made decentralized local action in the various localities where people live. So we will be updating and we'll be giving more information about this call for action, and in the meantime probably can check the website of Novox, that is novox.ras.org.uk, or novox.ras.org, I think is and or you can check the Habitants website, that is www.habitants.de. And well, we will update and we'll get link and information through Rampart in the UK, in London, and through different other kind of social center network in UK. Okay, thank you. Bye.
These days, it looks like the mainstream have finally caught up with the global drama of climate change. Free newspapers carry a full page on environmental issues every day. TV programs encourage us to use biofuels. Even some governments are talking about taking measures. Last Saturday, 9th of June 2007, Global Day of Action on Agriculture, Sergio explained how the biofuels are now called agrofuels, how they are already being transported around the world to reach the global elite who can afford them, how those agrofuels are coming, surprise, from monoculture estates in the global south the size of Britain, and why the switch from massive fossil fuels to massive agrofuels is already doing more harm to the environment and the dignity of life in the global south than it does good.
Yeah, I'm Sergio from Spain. We are right now going on the rally, which is taking place in Rostock, on the day, the Global Day of Action on Agriculture, during the protests against the G8 summit here in Heiligendamm. And during this rally, we are, you know, it's one of the really interesting events that is taking place during these protests, because it's linking up the farmers' movements from all over the world with the anti-capitalist movement, which is coming together here in Heiligendamm, which is mainly urban-based and is mainly people from Europe, even though there's people from other places as well coming. And it's very important to make this connection, because we are very interdependent on each other, and we, you know, like, we live in the world, which is in the part of the world and in the social sectors which are actually taking up increasing space and, you know, taking increasing resources from people from all over the world. And a very good example of this is what is happening now with biofuels. What used to be called biofuels are now the farmers' organizations in the south call agrofuels, which are crops that are normally planted in huge monocultures in order to produce basically substitutes for gasoline or diesel. For diesel it's biodiesel, for gasoline it's ethanol. And this is something that, well, recently at the European Union and the United States, there has been the decision to increase the amount of agrofuels in the transportation up to 10% in the case of the European Union and 20% in the case of the United States. And this is justified as part of the struggle against climate change. You know, it's justified with environmental reasons, with an environmental discourse, but this is actually just hiding the fact that the idea is basically to not do anything serious about climate change, concretely within transport, and get part of the supply for the, you know, the gasoline and the diesel from the people who are going to be paying the price are the rural communities, especially in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, so that we in the north and the rich people also from the south have access to an ever-increasing amount of individual transportation. But the climate effect of these biofuels is actually negative in the case of most of the biofuels. You need more energy to produce them than the amount of energy that you're going to get out of them. This is because of the way in which it is produced, you know, the methods in these monocultures, these huge monocultures, are very energy intensive. They also need a lot of pesticides and fertilizers, and then they need a lot of energy also for processing them and transporting them all over the world. And a lot of new infrastructures are being built for this purpose. And this is being now cultivated in land which was either rainforests and other, you know, untouched ecosystems that are being destroyed for this objective, or is being done in land which could be distributed for agrarian reform, for people being able to feed themselves. And it's taking not only immense amounts of land, but also immense amount of water. For instance, in Brazil, the area which is already covered with crops meant for agrofuels covers already an area equivalent to the size of the Great Britain, Ireland, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg together. This is today. Well, with the expansion plans, it will be much more. And in Indonesia, there's already immense monocultures devoted to palm plantation for biodiesel. The government has plans to increase those plantations to an extent that it will mean the displacement of 40 million people, who are right now indigenous peoples or farmers' communities, depending on the currently sustainable uses of the land, rainforest or traditional farming methods, in order to make space for those monocultures. And the amount of water that this needs, just to give you an example, the amount of water that is imported in the form of soy by China alone every year is almost as large as the complete consumption of water for domestic uses all over the world. And soy is one more of those crops that is being used for, you know, in order to do ethanol and biodiesel. So all this is happening at increasing speed because of these decisions taken, especially by the European Union and the United States. And, the consequences are clear. It's increasingly concentrated land ownership, meaning it's undoing land reform. You know, it's doing exactly the opposite than land reform. It's also concentrating the use of environmental space in the hands of the elite of consumers in the north and also in the south that have access to a life of excessive consumption. Because we are not only using environmental space to feed ourselves, but also for energy uses. It's not doing anything about climate change, because in fact, because of the way it is organized, this is not the way it has to be with biofuels. You can actually, if you use them locally, they can be part of the solution. But a global trade on agrofuels definitely contributes to the problem of climate change. And it's also bringing increasing problems also of violence, displacement, and human rights violations. A good example of this is Colombia, where the monocultures of palm plantations have been driven by paramilitary violence, massacring communities, doing displacements, forced displacement of communities, and killing up to hundreds of people in one single military operation in order to make space for these plantations of agrofuels. So all this is happening on behalf of the environment, and many people here in the north believe that this is part of the solution. That's why it's so important for us to listen to what is actually happening in these countries where these monocultures are being expanded, to see, you know, also environmental consequences like the huge fires in Indonesia, besides the displacement of people and the destruction of the rainforest. And see what we can do from our side, because in fact the expansion of agrofuels is happening because of part of the campaigning that we've been doing for many years in order to raise awareness about climate change and, you know, to try to promote renewable energies. So in the same way, we can deny the fact that this is part of the solution and try to stop this destructive development and bring back the question to where it should be. Like, how do we stop this mode of development which is basically doesn't have enough space on the earth to continue expanding we already reached the environmental limits. So that's the real question that we have to be dealing with. And for that, it's very important to link up with the rural struggles of the South.
Resource conflicts, dictatorships, economic and ecological devastation. The African continent is particularly affected by the serious consequences of neoliberal trade policies. The situation is also the background for the flight and migration of hundreds of thousands of people from Africa to Europe. The year 2006 has the highest death rate of African boat people in the Mediterranean and Atlantic Ocean. While the blockaders attempted to bring the G8 meetings to a halt with their five-finger technique, the alternative summit was underway in Rostock Harbour. The discussion, "We're here because you are there, structural causes of migration," brought together activists from different initiatives in Eastern Europe and Africa with refugees initiatives in Europe. Gieki Tano from the African Trade Network, Ghana, spoke about free trade agreements and their effect on immigration and set out the historical context.
Raise the whole question of migration. But before I do that, I would like to make an historical reference. We have to ask the question, why Africa? It is not the only place in the world where natural resources exist. There's also oil in Europe. It does not lead to civil war. It is not the only place on earth that where country economies are running a deficit or individuals are in debt. I suspect most of you here are in debt to your credit card company. Yet, there's no war. Yet, there's no war. It is not the only country in the world where other resources such as fish stock and so on are being plundered, yet elsewhere there is no war. So you still have to ask the question, why Africa? And there's actually only one word that can give an answer to that question, and that word is called capitalism. The way in which Africa historically has been integrated into the world economy explains a lot. In the first place, we know that capitalism arrived in Africa late, relatively speaking. It arrived accompanied by massive violence. It arrived in a highly uneven fashion, penetrating some parts almost completely, almost immediately, leaving wholesale untouched other parts, yet managing to destroy, without replacing with anything, long-established traditional historical forms of livelihood, forms of economic activity, forms of economic relations. This is the first picture to bear in mind. Volatility, unevenness, that's the first. The second thing to bear in mind, I think, is also the fact that within this volatility and within this unevenness, there has grown a particular regime of politics within Africa. If you take the effect of colonialism, one of the things that it did in a way in which was not the same in either Asia or Latin America, was that in Africa, no indigenous capitalist, rival capitalist class was allowed to emerge. The fact is that those who came to the head of the independence movement, those who became the new ruling class, unlike the bourgeoisie of Europe, had not developed their economic power through economic means within the society over centuries. Overnight, you have a new ruling class in economies still dominated by and large by European interests, in societies where already there are people who have successfully fought off global powers, who are militant, who are ready to fight. In such a circumstance, the new political class has to find the quickest possible means to accumulate its own economic wealth whilst retaining all the repressive apparatus that colonialism developed to impose its rule in Africa. The main two points that arise, I think, is the destabilizing impact of capitalism and also the type of political regime that accompanies it. And those two points today, those two factors, should I say, today, are being entrenched even more deeply, are being institutionalized on an even more permanent basis through free trade agreements. There is a particular and specific parts of the free trade agreements that touch on the question of migration. First and foremost, again, let's look at the question of migration, not in a one-sided way. There are many European migrants who go to Africa all the time, not just those who sell arms, But it includes all the top range of multinationals. In fact, there are labor markets, segments of labor markets in Africa, which are exclusively European. The top oil executives, the top international banking multinationals. So that's the first thing. The second thing is also that the on the reverse side is other African migrants who have some technical or other skills like doctors and so on and so forth, part of that whole brain ring. My point is that the EPA specifically endorses this type of migration. It tells governments that you no longer have the right to limit, to interfere, even to allow, let alone prohibit, the entrance of business operators within the free trade area. Business operators obviously defined according to the capital turnover of the company and so on. So it would mean European businesses and European business executives with all their families, trains, puppies, I'll say dogs, whatever they have, without limitation. On the other hand, just as someone else mentioned, you have a situation where those with professional skills from Africa, from the Caribbean, and the Pacific will be allowed to enter into and form a part of the labor competition within certain service niches or other certain labor markets within Europe, whose effect, it is true, is to drive down conditions, one of whose effects is to drive down conditions for those who are already working in those areas. The third is stipulation. Is that those who are below a certain threshold of technical or educational skill, those who are below a certain threshold of economic means, actually are subjected to a more stringent exclusionary regime, that visa regime. So yes, you might have your guest workers and so on and so forth. It is not accounted for specifically in the trade agreement, because the trade agreement is liberalization. So the trade agreement only specifically talks about the categories of migration where limitations should be removed. So more doctors from Africa to Europe, more oil executives and banking executives from Europe to Africa. That, there should be no restriction. But when it comes to other things, they said all other national security laws not referred to in this agreement will apply. So that's outside of the trade agreement. Again, this is not free trade. This is monopoly, selective, and so on and so forth.
Here a member from Attack Japan talking about their plans for the next G8 in Japan.
Go Hirasawa.
I will translate.
Yeah. Now I asked if you can read it again in English, and then I wanted to know what your plans are for Japan.
Sorry.
Uh-huh. What are your plans for Japan?
Uh-huh. 一体あなた今その声明を読み上げてくれましたけども、あなたのその日本でどういうことを計画しているのかということをちょっと簡単に話していただけますかと。
一応ですね、まだ準備段階なんですけど、とにかくその幅広いネットワークを作って。なんだろう、その広い運動の作り方というのをしていきたいというふうに思っています。
Now, we are starting, we are preparing the networking process. We, No G8 Japan Project, want to network a broad coalition against G8 in Japan.
だからまだちょっと開催地が決まったばかりなので、そのどういう実際的な、実務的にどういう行動をするかっていうのはまだまだまだの段階なんですけど、とにかくネットワークを広げることで、かつ国際的な連帯をしていくことで、来年の反 G8 を成功させたいなというふうに思って。
Decision of the place of G8 summit was in this year, in January. So we have very short time to prepare our movement. But so practically we have planning now.But I want to make a broad network inside, outside our country to make a big demonstration against GA.
I wanted to ask, now, I know the German anti-G8 coalition worked for like 18 months, so they had more time. But do you think you'll be able, in the short time you've got, you'll be able to organize similar demonstrations of the same magnitude?
ドイツの場合は18ヶ月の準備期間があったと、でそれでこれだけの規模になったんだけれども、非常に短い期間で、ドイツと同じぐらいのことはあなたはやれると思いますかと。
まあ、I hope so, but、まあ、望みますけど、ちょっと期間が短いので、ただここで見たものをとにかく日本に伝えて、これから学んで、あと日本のまあこれまでの運動の文脈も活かせてミックスさせるようなものになれば、きっと成功するんじゃないかなというふうに考えています。
I hope we will success. Yes, we know the difficulty because of our short time, but our participation in this Rostock G8 is very important. We are learning from the German movement experience, and we will inform the what will be happening in the Rostock, and we mix with the Japanese movement experience and with the German movement experience. And so I hope and I expect we will be a huge demonstration in next year, right?
We would like to offer our thanks for this series to the Dutch solar-powered media bus, everyone at the Frieda School and Media Center in Rostock, the Radio Forum, Radio Jetsam, Stefan at the IMC tent in Redelich, all people who took their time to speak to us, everybody who gave support and advice to Flash Radio, and of course everybody who worked tirelessly on it in London, Heiligendamm and Berlin. Join our mailing list to hear about our future podcasts.
Dear listeners, this is not our last podcast. We will come back to you with some special features from Berlin and more. Please check our webpage www.flashradio.wordpress.com or email us at flashradio@activix.org. Thanks a lot and hear you soon.